how do you know when you know it? When you're receiving all these teachings, how do you know that you've actually gotten what's being taught? There are some people who say that you know it when you can live the teachings. But there's a lot of teachings that don't seem to sort of directly point you at a specific way of how you should live it. Aside from perhaps the teachings about precepts. And, you know, particularly about koans and parts of sutras, and, you know, I find myself being pretty sure I've heard what the teaching was, and I've nodded along, but have I really understood it? So I want to start off with that koan that a lot of us are familiar with, Gutai's one finger. And that's the koan where the poor assistant gets his finger chopped off. And just briefly, just a part of that koan, I'm just going to read out loud, not the whole thing. Whenever he was asked about the way, Master Gutai simply stuck up his finger. He had a boy attendant whom a visitor asked, "What kind of teaching does your master give?" The boy held up one finger. Hearing this, Gutai cut off the boy's finger with a knife. And there's more to the koan than just that. But one way of looking at this is that trying to understand teaching, one shouldn't just simply parrot or repeat what a teacher says. That there's more to it than that. And in the past, when listening to teachers give talks, and particularly I recall in Boundless Way Sesshins, I would often notice that some of the teachers have the same words or phrasing that perhaps their own teacher uses. And that kind of made me suspicious, because I began to think, well, whose Zen am I actually hearing? Am I hearing the teacher's, or am I hearing the teacher's teacher's Zen? And and the reason that made me suspicious is that I had this theory that you don't really understand a teaching until you're able to speak it or interpret it with your own personal words. And an example of that for me was early in my practice, we often discuss opening the hand of thought. Josh gave me that, pointed me to that book early on, and I read it probably once and a half times, and opening the hand of thought seems like something that's should be easy to understand. But I never really, that phrase never really gelled with me. What had stuck with me when sitting Zazen was another kind of metaphor. And that was holding a bag of groceries, an unwieldy paper bag of groceries filled with cans, probably packed poorly, so it leans, and you really have to hold on to it, or you feel like you have to hold on to it. And so I often felt that sitting in Zazen, I was holding this unwieldy bag. But that sometimes there were opportunities to simply place that bag gently on my lap. Or sometimes there were opportunities to place that bag to the side. But always this worry that the bag would fall. Always this worry that you need to pay attention to that. And but eventually in the Zazen, letting go to the possibility of just let that bag fall over. Just let the cans roll around. Just let it make a big, embarrassing crash. And so, to me, that kind of metaphor struck me more deeply than opening the hand of thought. So, you know, I had this intellectual understanding of what opening the hand of thought meant. But it felt like it was somebody else's words. And so, I think we're kind of on the wrong path when we're trying to understand Zen and we're looking at, sort of the dictionary definitions of terms, or we're trying to remember the way that somebody said it who said it very well. We're trying to almost memorize what that way was, or we're hoping that if we can come up with a clever way of expressing something and holding on to that cleverness. And so it made me think, well, for myself, is there a way I can tell when I really understand something or I'm able to express my understanding? And that made me think, sometimes it feels like if I'm able to express something using the words that I used when I was younger, or the words that I grew up with, like say the phrasing or the patterns of words from my mother, for example, or even being open up to swear occasionally. I think that for myself and many people, I believe that we're quietly swearing under our breath, that in our minds we're punctuating our thoughts with little or big swears. And so those are the things that are actually going on inside our heads. And, you know, of course, I'm not saying throw out swears just all over the place, because, you know, like anything, it can be used gratuitously. But, you know, sometimes those are the words that one grew up using, maybe the words that one heard, either fortunately or unfortunately, in the household. These are the kinds of things that I feel get one's attention. There's nothing like, hearing a phrase from your parents or perhaps stumbling across something your parents are gone that they perhaps wrote and really giving you a jolt. And I think when you can understand the teachings in a way that really give you that jolt, then you're probably on the right path to understanding these teachings. In thinking about this, I've also have a kind of a different spin on another very common well-known koan, and that's from the Gateless Gate 23, the sixth ancestor and the original face or the original self. This is the famous one where the sixth ancestor has been given, secretly been given transmission, but is told from the fifth ancestor, don't, you're probably going to be in danger. You should flee the monastery and don't teach for a while. And sixth ancestor flees the monastery. He's being chased by several monks and is finally chased by a monk called Nyo, who is after the ceremonial robe and bowl that this newly transmitted teacher is carrying. And so, briefly, an excerpt from that somewhat long koan is this. So this is Myo speaking to the sixth ancestor. I came for the doctrine, not for the robe. I beg you to teach your servant. The sixth ancestor said, do not think this is good, this is bad. At such moment, what is the original self of Monk Myo? Also sometimes said as, what is the original face of Monk Myo? So my spin on this is, what are the original words that we use? For myself, I find that Zen practice has helped me strip away the layers of the self that I've added to create what I consider the modern James. So this is all the stuff I added as a teenager, as a college graduate, as a professional, as a parent, and I've stacked up on top of myself, and I call that James. And my Zen practice is helping me strip away that. And I often find myself getting down to the parts of James as a younger man, or James before he thought that he had some sort of abilities that people appreciated and needed. I encourage you to think about these teachings without relying on the words that you've come to use as a professional in your life, big words and jargon, and those words that you've found comfort in because you've got a facility with writing or facility with public speaking, and look deeper than that. Look what's going on, or look at more of those original words that you once spoke. So I'm going to close with that. And, open this up, to comments, questions, tangents, orthogonal comments. Harry?
James, first, wonderful to have you giving a talk today on Saturday. Wonderful to see you here. So thank you so much. And you point to that koan, and I'm always delighted when we get pointed to these koans, because for some reason I feel like the first few months I was practicing Zen, koans of monks losing fingers and arms and other things kept popping up. I was like, what am I getting myself into? This is crazy. But your encouragement is wonderful for me, because it immediately brought up for me moments where I thought I got it. And I think maybe in those moments I did. And the one I remember very clearly, I think maybe it occurred within the first couple of years of practicing. And I might have been at Sesshin, but I remember I brought this. It was actually to Josh. I was like, oh, I get it. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Now I see it. And I felt like once I had that, and I had that in my head, I was like, as long as I remember those words correctly, I've got it. You know, I don't know what that means anymore. I forgot it. I don't know exactly. I can't explain to you what it was I got in that moment, but I got it. And now I've lost it. And I think when I go back to go get it, I try to go back into those words, those specific words, try to figure that out. And so what you're pointing to is this thing of that we so often, I think, run into Zen, which is never think you actually got it, first of all. But second of all, maybe getting it is just part of it, and a lot of getting it is forgetting it and then having to figure it out again in a different way. And I think I've been trying to figure it out in the same way. And I really appreciate you pointing out, like, yeah, you're probably not going to get it again if you keep going back to the words. What else is under there? So thank you so much, James. I really appreciate that teaching.
I think that's right. I recall many instances of, wow, I've really gotten something. And then many, an equal amount of instances of trying to explain that to someone, and just the words that come out of my mouth don't make sense to me anymore. And then I try harder, like, well, I really, like you say, really remember exactly what I heard and repeat it with great conviction. And no, the conviction that isn't doesn't help. And so, yeah, I do feel that you do have to go back. And it seems to me that my experience is repeatedly going back and really repeatedly going back, eventually something begins to make sense, but it wasn't written the way that I've heard it. There's something that I recognize that's a different set of words. Carol? No, you're on mute.
Thank you, James. As you were talking, it brought to mind for me just so much of my, like, this is so relatable as an experience of trying to use words that I've heard that make sense to me, that, like, that there's something about it that I've gotten. And as a, like, professionally, I'm a teacher and an experience designer. So for me, finding the right path through to be able to kind of express something or show something to someone is so essential to the nature of the way my mind works. So I'm always kind of trying to find a new way, or like the way that I can try to expose people to these concepts that to me now seem so fundamental, right? Where I now have this understanding of interdependence, and that just is just so obviously true. And I can't see how anyone cannot see this now. And so I'm trying to express it to people, and the words that come out of my mouth just sound crazy. I just sound like I just have some very, very strange thoughts or magical type of thinking, but that's not the case. So, I really appreciate the idea of, you know, finding words that work for you, finding new ways to express something to someone. And I'm going to be taking that with me as I develop more in this practice. Thank you.
Yeah, that reminds me of years ago when I first had this idea that I expressed in this talk. I was actually trying to explain it to dental hygienist who was about to clean my teeth, and I thought I could really explain this well because I had been thinking about it that day, and the look on her face as I tried, because she had expressed interest in Buddhism and teaching, and and I tried to explain this, and the look of puzzlement on her face, I was like, wow, I'm really not getting this across at all. Fran?
James, I want to thank you for what I consider a very courageous talk. I think it takes a lot of guts to kind of challenge the dogma and sort of this this line that we feel like we need to parrot in order to have it. Also to comment that my experience is sort of this spiral of kind of having these flashes on getting it and then losing it and then having another sort of aha moment where something opens up a little differently and sort of keep coming back to this over and over again. And, it opens up in new and different ways for me. As time goes on. And I love your call for authenticity. I totally agree with you. And I feel like that's what we're asked to do, is to come forward with our authentic manifestation of this thing that's ineffable, that, you know, we can't really put words to. But the more authentic ways it gets expressed, then that creates a context for when, you know, something else happens to me, I can say, oh, that makes sense. Now I know what that feels like or what that is like. But hearing it from different people in an authentic way is what I find helpful. And I agree, you know, not just parroting the sutras or, you know, whatever catchy phrase your teacher used that you happen to like that sounds good. So anyway, wonderful talk. Thank you so much, Jay.
Yeah, and so I feel I often hunger for hearing words from teachers that you really get a sense of either what they're like or what their understanding is from the point of view of not wearing that robe, I guess I would say. It's kind of like almost like if you were having a one-on-one conversation with a friend at a bar and you really heard them express something that really makes you say, I understand who you are and where you're coming from. It's a difficult thing to do, and on both sides, to hear it and also to present that, and therefore that's it's a rare thing.
say Brad James?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks. Yeah, great talk, because it points to something too that's like kind of like a sticking point in practice, which is letting go of trying to figure it out. And then when you start to let go of trying to figure it out, which isn't so easy to do because that's all society's telling us to do. And that's what we do naturally, try to figure everything out intellectually. Letting go of that, and then this big dummy sitting there, and it's like, is Buddha nature really going to come? Is that possible for this big dummy sitting here? And just trusting, you know, the trust. Just because the porch light's not going on every time and all the time, in fact, 99.99999% of the time, you add a lot of nines onto that, it isn't. And trusting that's really, you know, that's really the practice. Quite often teachers somehow and other Sangha members can like sort of unlock something, you know, because they say something. It's like, oh, and it helps with an opening. So, you know, having the courage to trust that this imperfect, flawed, you know, human being, can access, you know, can be, is part of this one seamless body and, can't really express it in words, But the best thing somebody said to me yesterday, some guy at work said that I had just met, said, you seem really laid back. Now, that's the first time anybody's ever said that to me, so maybe the practice worked a bit, but who knows. But thank you. That really is huge what you're pointing to today, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Brad. I also want to say that, you know, that sometimes there can be value in hearing things that you actually don't understand and feel very frustrated about that and kind of blame your teacher for that. I recall Josh giving a talk once and about a subject that I felt like, well, that's inconsequential. That's, why did he waste our time talking about that? And it really got under my skin. And I sort of held on that for a while, and then I began to realize, well, because I was like under my skin as something like irritating, actually made me bring it up from time to time. I was like, oh, that thing that he talked about that really annoyed me. I wonder if that applies here. And so, there is still, I think even, still room for even that, even the poorly given, talks, can eventually find useful. Some things have a way of sticking to you, even that way.
Thank you for the talk, James. I know, it's kind of experience you talk about having some kind of, you know, opening, seeing something fresh, and then having some words for it or having an image for it. And sometimes, I mean, this is something I've had a lot. And sometimes the phrase is something from a sutra book, like Harry said, oh, form is actually emptiness. What do you know? And sometimes it is kind of a childish statement one thing I've had over and over again in Sesshin is, oh, you mean it's not all about me? It's, you know, it's a very human, you know, kind of phrasing. You won't find that in any sutra book, but that's my, you know, that is how I characterize that moment of insight. And, you know, I will often think of, you know, have some word or phrase, and that will help it keep fresh, and then it fades. It's just that those words just, you know, I think back at it, you know, 2 days later, and maybe it still has meaning, and 4 days later, it's like, boy, yeah, just flat, you know, nothing to it at all. And I think that's natural, because I mean, what our practice is pointing us towards is not that insight we had 4 days ago. It's what's happening now. So actually, what one of the koans I love the most isn't fancy, isn't a long story, doesn't have any difficult Chinese names. I believe it's used a lot in the Korean tradition. Simply, what is this? What is this? You know, not this from 4 days ago. What is this? thank you, James. Because in a way, whenever we get to formulating something, we've already frozen that past moment. And so part of our process, yeah, when we have the moment, we freeze it. That's just what we do. That carries on for a little while. And then it's time to let go of that one and come back to something new. So thank you, James.
Yeah, I agree. I've passed a number of koans, but for the life of me, a lot of them, I look back and I have no idea what I once said or once expressed.
Yep.
And I have this awful fear that should I be called upon to express that again, I would like give it away that maybe I know that you have visiting koans over and over again is very helpful, and, but that fear, kind of like those high school dreams of those dreams of going back to high school and sitting at exam you know nothing about, would happen to me again. I would be asked about a koan and feel like, oh my God, I don't know this, but at one point someone told me that I apparently did.
James, I don't know if you can see that Joanna has her hand up. Oh, and I see Rick's hand, too.
Let's see. Who was you first said?
Joanna?
Yeah. Yeah, your talk really reminds me of maybe in the first year or 2 years when I first started practicing, when I was 16, 17, really young, I sort of treated coming into practice on Saturdays or in the evenings as going to class. And I had to remember, you know, if there was a Dharma talk, I had to very carefully remember everything that was said and then make sure I can remember it for next year, you know? And yeah, but now I realize, you know, maybe it's not that important to remember everything. You know, maybe some things you remember, they don't even make sense to you right away. And often, I find it's not necessarily, while sitting that I'll have a realization or I'll understand something. It's while living my daily life, something I learn, while doing Zen will come up in a different way. And if I can be open to that, something will seem really familiar. I say, oh, it's the same, you know, there's a common line here. And then maybe I'll remember it, but maybe I won't remember it until that teaching, until 3 or 4 times that happens to me in my daily life. The teaching will kind of show up in the most random ways.
And you know, sometimes you need to hear that topic from several different people, or topic gets brought up by a comment from somebody else in a completely different talk. And I think sometimes you begin to realize that some things are related to each other, and maybe you don't understand this particular thing, but another thing that's nearby to it, maybe you understand a little bit about that.
I'm a koan rookie. I have to admit that. I have some, like a poem I got from my grandparents' Bible that I printed out and give to people. Seeing people who are ill and maybe having some difficulties, with depression or self-doubt. And I was pointing out some of the lines to this person yesterday, and I said, that doesn't sound like the one I've been reading, you know? It's not the same thing. So I tried to rephrase it into my own belief system, you know, how your beliefs change a little bit over time. And so, yeah, I agree with what you're saying, getting down to the basics of your gut feeling, right? Re-examining it, you know, looking at it again. And like Duane was saying, that it comes to you at different times of the day, you know, that teaching will come back. But I had a beautiful experience today. I was out in my kayak this morning. So I got here late, I have to admit. But just experiencing this big lake around me and nature and how, your perspective changes sometimes when you get that little glimpse of, like Brad was saying, more than 9% of the time we don't get it, but sometimes that light comes on. Nature does that to me, you know, just seeing the moons or being really close to a set of moons or something like that. I don't know, I'm pretty rambling, but that's what the moment does, I guess. Thank you.
Yeah, and I think that I believe that growing up, I really wasn't really paying attention to nature that much. And even though I was attempting to do farming junior and senior year of high school, I actually hated doing it, and therefore was probably not very much paying attention to nature. But I think over time, paying attention to nature has sort of I've grown into, and therefore I think the teachings you learn from nature can come into your life at any point. It doesn't have to have been something you grew up with. It could be things that you experience, you know, much later in life. As long as you hopefully can maintain an openness, which I find harder and harder to do as I get older, you can hear more of these teachings. Jim?
James, I want to deeply appreciate your talk. I am comforted in knowing that I'm not the only person who turns this topic for and for. I have in my life lots. One of the things I'm taking away from this talk about, you know, how we, you know, we can have this idea of getting it and then trying to express what that it is, later. One of the things that's arising for me is this idea that people have used the phrase frequently through the dialogue is what we're pointing to. Is that, you know, what we're pointing to, that's all we can do. We can't. You know, it's that idea that, you know, why gaze at the finger when you can stand in awe of the moon? Sometimes I can only talk about the finger. I'm trying to point to the moon. And it's also the perspective. I love your hygienist thing. You know, I mean, I might think that the hygienist is standing right here, but the hygienist is standing way over there, and I'm pointing from this perspective, and they're not going to see it. And I look like I'm nuts, right? And I'm actually tying this to the teaching that everything's one big mistake. And how I do that is that I take apart the word miss and take. That once I've got it, as soon as I'm away from it, whatever I've taken is a miss. Right. And I just got to move on with the next mistake. Everything is one big mistake, because once I've got it, it's gone. And that's a really important teaching for me today. So thank you.
Yeah, and actually, that word mistake, I think that that's one of those words which I think many of us, I mean, I think we all think we know what that word means. And, but I bet you that many of us have different flavors or interpretations of that word. And that can be a word that's definitely probably used by our parents, right? In a very particular way. And that word, you know, and so when we use the phrase, you know, one continuous mistake, for example, I think for a lot of people, they have a very emotional reaction to that word mistake, and that's going to vary among people. And so probably in one's understanding of one continuous mistake, you have to grapple with, well, what does mistake really mean for me?
James, I see Catherine Wong has her hand up.
Catherine.
Hi. I actually did have an emotional reaction when you said the word mistake. Got a little soaked up by that. Thank you. I wanted to comment on what Dorna and Jim were saying a little bit. I think for me, there's definitely a period of time where I was doing everything with such like a perfectionistic tendency that it would prevent me from doing anything, because the mindset was if I watched anything, if I listened or read anything at all, I had to memorize and hear the whole thing. And you know, there's been a shift recently for me where that's been less rigid, and just been thinking about how, I don't know, even if I'm not consciously remembering it, maybe in some way that it's altering something for me on a subconscious level that I can't see or really name or recognize yet. And also I think that it's really important that when I'm listening to the talks to be paying attention to how my mind and body feel, not in a like a grasping way where I want to like listen and remember everything, but more so seeing what it is that strikes. Like, I guess when you were talking about, like, an example just now is, like, when you were talking about the word mistake, I was like, it's like, whoa, I, like, really felt something in my body, and I feel like that's significant, right, to reflect on. And so maybe it's not necessarily trying to capture the all, but trying to see what it is that feels significant in the moment as you're listening to it. Thank you.
Yeah, and I sometimes have a hard time staying focused in Dharma talks. I have a tendency for my mind to wander, and sometimes I do find it helpful to not get caught up in trying to force myself to really pay attention, but to trust what my body is feeling. And see where that takes me, instead of trying to be focused like I think I should be, like I was in college, that kind of thing, listening to lectures, that, trusting your body as you're listening. It's hard for me to do, personally. I always want to rely on my mind. Julie?
I know I've already spoken once, but I just wanted to comment on this last exchange of you and Kat. I remember there have been some times in Dharma talks where the teacher has said to just kind of let the talk flow over you, you know, rather than try to work at it. And I think that's, because I especially, you know, those of us with college educations and perhaps beyond and everything else, we're so used to using our analytical mind that we forget. I mean, our incense and our candles and our rituals and our images are all coming at us in this different way, and to just sit and be open that way too. However, I would add one caution on that we do still need our analytical mind. A couple of years ago, I was reading up on cults, and one of the things they do is just tell their listeners to just let the teachings wash over you. And you know, if you take that to an extreme, you forget about your analytical mind, and you forget about, well, they just told me to give them all their money, but maybe I shouldn't. You know, it's good to keep a little bit of that around. But yeah, we do have so much in our practice that is not aimed at that we need to open to.
Okay, I think that's it. Thank you, everyone, for your comments. Really appreciate it.